You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the birth rate in the United States dropped to its lowest point in 35 years in 2019. We'll talk to a sociologist about that news and what factors are playing a role in the drop. First, it's been an emotional time, including a lot of sadness, but it's also been a time to find some joy, maybe in things that you'd never considered or thought about being joyful before. In a project for the New York Times, 14 writers shared something that's brought them joy lately, from doing a little digital cleanup on their cell phones to taking the same walk every day. Anya Strumian is a deputy editor in the Style section of the New York Times. She edited that project. It's called 14 Ways We're Finding Joy in Spite of Everything. Anya, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Well, we'll get into some of the specific stories of joy, but a common theme seems to be, and it's kind of a cliche, but it seems a lot of people found joy in the little things.
Yes. When I first approached all these writers and said, you know, what, if anything, is bringing you joy right now, I expected their answers to be a bit wilder, frankly. I thought surely, you know, among the 14 of them, someone would be like screaming from the rooftop or, you know, singing lyrics aloud, running down the street because no one else is there, to something. But there was nothing like that. Every answer sort of felt simple and almost subdued. So I just kind of realized that, you know, the smaller our world has become, the more pleasure we've found in the simple things.
Can you talk about why you went into this project, why you went searching for joy?
Gladly, yeah. So back as a deputy editor on the Style section, part of my job is to put together these special projects. And I was last with you in January when I did a package on quitting things.
Right.
And so it's a very fun job. But back in January, as I was thinking about the year ahead, I thought, you know, what is the ultimate counter programming for New York Times readers? How could we surprise them the most? And things were already feeling kind of dark in January. You know, if you can even remember back that far, Australia was burning. There was a Senate impeachment trial underway. We were maybe going to war with Iran. You know, things felt heavy. So I thought, I know, let's do a package on fun or joy. So that was on my mind. And then as the pandemic, you know, hit in, you know, and became a pandemic in March, I thought, well, the last thing I'm feeling right now is joy, which is all the more reason I should be doing this. If I need it, I'm sure readers need it. And so that's when I started sending emails out to these writers.
And something you say in the, I think this is you saying this in the piece, that joy is joy any way you slice it. It doesn't seem like we can really predict where it might come from or, you know, set out on a path that we know is going to bring us joy. It's just, we find it somewhere sometimes.
Yes. And I mean, I've personally been finding it in very simple ways, and I'm very curious to hear from listeners how they've been finding joy. But, you know, I've barely left my apartment. And so, you know, it's not like I'm not having fun or not. And these are very, very difficult times for all of us in so many different ways. I can't actually ever remember any more difficult times. But, you know, I think that it's sort of human nature to find fun or pleasure in the hardest of times. So it was kind of beautiful to draw that out in people.
We're talking to Anya Strumian, deputy editor in the Style section of the New York Times. She edited the project. We're talking about 14 ways we're finding joy in spite of everything. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you found something, maybe a little thing, that brings you joy in your life, despite the bad news out there, the precautions we've been taking? Is there a little something, and maybe it is little, that's made you happy from day to day? Call in at 800-642-1234. Anya, let's check out some of the stories you shared here. This one I love. I'm a regular breakfast eater, but the writer here, Max Reed, isn't. The joy of consuming an obscene number of calories before noon. Can you talk about his joy in breakfast?
Sure. So before this time, he was in the before times, let's say, he was not a big breakfast eater. He said that at most he would have like black coffee, and if he was really hungry, he would add milk. So he talked about how busy his life was before, that, you know, as soon as he got out of bed, life was all about answering emails or pretending to answer emails or, you know, putting off answering emails. And of course, commuting. But now he has all the time in the world. He just kind of responds to his body's needs. And he says what his body needs sometimes is a kimchi grilled cheese before 10 a.m. And, you know, I think we've all definitely been doing a lot more cooking. So he was really luxuriating in that, without the commute, we can, you know, go crazy, especially with bacon in his case.
A lot of people, I think, as you say, have turned to food in one way or another. We asked around here at WPR, Chris Deering, our business sponsorship manager, says, since the quarantine began, my kids are home all the time. I've started having them pick out a fancy recipe or meal of their choosing at least once a week. It's been a joy working side by side with my daughters, Chris writes, and teaching them how to chop, mince, measure, sear, saute, bake, and broil their way to a delicious meal. So I love that cooking, but not just cooking, cooking with the kids. Have you found, Anya, joy in food in some way?
Yes. I just always love eating. I'm a very hungry person. But as a New Yorker, I was always going out to eat or ordering delivery. So it's been really nice to return to cooking. And I've mostly my husband cooks, but I've picked up some of the slack because it's too much for one person to handle. And my 3-year-old has started like helping out as much as he can, which usually means just playing with ice and water, but it's so sweet. And this time is sort of priceless in that sense, the togetherness. It's joyous.
Another common joy, and this is one I've enjoyed a lot. You know, I can't go out and do the stuff, say, after work that I usually would. So I just go for a walk, usually in my neighborhood. I see the same thing again and again. Our own Susanna Michaels and our fundraising team has done something similar. She takes the same walk along a lake and through a park. And one of your writers talked about just the sheer joy of circling the block, getting out and walking around the block a few times. Could you share that story?
Yeah, I loved this because it was sort of I don't know. I found it sort of surprisingly surprising that she circles the block once in the morning, you know, once in the afternoon, once while she's doing phone calls, five times while she's on her therapy call, and then once when work is over. And it's sort of a way to mark the time in the day, but also, of course, to get fresh air, to see her neighbors. I think we've all sort of gotten to know our neighbors a little bit better because in the past we weren't home. We were home a lot less. So observing your neighborhood is sort of this like meditative act. And to her, it was about building community, getting exercise and getting fresh air.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Kent with us in Washburn. Kent, hi.
Hello. Well, on Friday, my wife told me that she'd come across a request for people to play taps at 3 p.m. on Memorial Day. And I hadn't picked up my cornet for decades. But I decided on Saturday I'd give it a try. And I couldn't even find the notes. I literally could not get it to produce the notes that I wanted it to produce. I thought I'll give it a try again on Sunday. And it was a little bit better. So I decided to do it, and we live in the woods up on a big hill looking over a valley. And so at 3 p.m. on Memorial Day afternoon, I stepped out onto the deck and aimed it out over the valley and played taps. And it worked. And
good for you.
It was a meaningful way to be a part of Memorial Day. It turned out to be a really good thing.
I love that story, Kat, but I got to ask, now that you're getting your lip back, are you going to keep it up?
Well, I'm planning to try it again today.
Fantastic. Kent, good luck. And that's a brass instrument, so you got to keep plugging away. Thank you so much for sharing that. I know, you know, I do a lot of my own music here, maybe more than I usually do. I play saxophone and piano and drums in decreasing orders of goodness there. Have you, Anya, seen either from your contributors or for other people you know, them turning to their old ways of being creative, musically or otherwise?
Huh. Nothing is coming to me right now. I'm trying to listen to more music just to kind of escape the news once in a while.
Fair.
Just as a matter of survival. But people are doing a lot of writing because I am getting a lot of submissions and a lot of pitches. And while I really appreciate them, it's really hard to keep up with. Everyone is finally ready to write either their, you know, personal essay or the next great American novel. So it seems that people are writing a lot.
Fantastic. Thanks for that call. We're talking to Anya Stremian, a deputy editor at the New York Times Style section. We're talking about a piece she edited called 14 Ways We're Finding Joy in Spite of Everything. You can find that at nytimes.com/joy. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a little something that's been bringing you joy lately in spite of the bad news out there? Call in at 800-642-1234 and tell us about it. Could be something big, could be something small. 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Anya Stremian with the New York Times. She edited the project 14 Ways We're Finding Joy in Spite of It All. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What are you turning to find joy in your life amidst the bad news lately? We heard from Meg, who wrote on the Ideas Network Facebook page. She wrote, gardening has always been my joy, and that hasn't changed. And our own Melissa Ingalls of Morning Edition says, I can't grow anything worth a darn, but I planted clover seeds in the bare spots in my yard, and they sprouted. They're actually growing. And Anya, one of your contributors, had a story with a similarly, I think, humble growing project. Can you share that one? Onions, I think it was. Scallions.
I was like, are you really? This is your joy right now. But she wrote so beautifully about it. And I realized, you know what? I can't judge. It does indeed sound incredibly peaceful and joyful. This was Jenna Wortham, who hosts a podcast called Still Processing. And she planted, I think she took the scraps of her scallions when she was cooking, put them in a glass of water, and the next day they were sprouting, and she's been eating them, and her greatest joy right now is checking on them daily. Apparently regrowing scallions is a really big thing, I learned via Google.
Fantastic. Yeah, I planted my usual, you know, probably going to fail veggie garden this year, and it gives me a reason to go out in the backyard and look at stuff, and yeah, so it is kind of a fun thing to check in on. Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in New Glarus. Steve, hi.
Hi, how you doing? I wanted to mention, I'm a disabled Vietnam vet. I spent 4 years in the Marine Corps, and I can't get out and walk a whole lot anymore, but I have a nice house where I can sit up on the second floor and look out my windows, and I have a big fir tree and a big apple tree right outside of my window on the second floor here. I just had a bald eagle fly in here about 5 minutes ago.
And wow.
I get some beautiful, beautiful birds in here, cardinals. The bald eagle is a magnificent bird to see when they come. When they get up right by your window, it's just really great to sit here and watch the different kinds of birds. I bought a couple bird books so that I can start identifying them, and there's at least 6 different types of birds that come in here to my different. I got it, like I said, a fir tree and an apple tree.
Fantastic!
Right, I can almost touch the branches out my window.
Steve, thank you so much for that call. It is majestic seeing a bald eagle that close. I saw a sandhill crane actually fly over our backyard this morning before I started working. Wow, that's quite a great story, just to seeing that nature and coming right to his back door, basically, Anya.
What a great spotting. And it's funny because here in the city, my friends and I have gotten very into bird watching as well, with so much less traffic. The birds in Brooklyn, where I live, are really thriving. So we've been trading spottings and what we see and helping each other identify birds.
That's fantastic.
But nothing as cool as a bald eagle yet.
Steve, thank you so much for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Justin with us now in Kenosha. Justin, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my phone call. This is a really cool topic. I'm a mental health therapist, and I've always tried to do this to have good work-life balance. So honestly, I'm not really doing anything differently. It's just amazing to see someone else taking advantage of this time. I still work out. I still garden. So I'm really happy to see people kind of reconnecting with these good things in life.
Is that something you counsel people on, Justin, as a therapist, to find, again, those little things that we could find moments of joy, even if, you know, we're in a period of our lives, whether as individuals or big picture, that isn't so great overall?
Yeah, I work in an ER, and people are coming in pretty big distress, like in pretty big numbers. And we used to just say, okay, go see a therapist, go see your doc, get some meds, but they can't do it anymore. And a lot of people are drinking really heavily because they can't go to AA. So I'll just kind of talk with them, spend like 5-10 minutes and say like, well, what do you enjoy doing? What kind of feeds you? What kind of brings you happiness? And then they kind of talk with me and they're like, wow, I really do enjoy this. I enjoy that. And they kind of reconnect with who they really are.
Justin, thank you so much for sharing that. That's great. And Anya, for some reason, that reminds me of one of your contributors who found joy in an unexpected place, an old Nintendo console that I think her husband pulled out of the closet.
Yes. She said that, you know, every night after she put her daughter to bed, she began her crying hour. And one night her husband couldn't take it anymore. So he went into their closet and found her old Nintendo closet. And grabbed two glasses of whiskey, and they just sort of went at it, each taking turns playing their favorite games. And she really lost herself, and that is kind of a throwback to her childhood. And it was just like, as a former user of Nintendo, it's so meditative. I might have to pick one up myself.
We are talking to Anya Stremian with the New York Times. She edited a project called 14 Ways We're Finding Joy in Spite of Everything. Back to your calls and your stories of how you find joy in tough times at 800-642-1234. We've got Mark with us now in Watertown. Mark, hello.
Good afternoon.
What do you want to tell us about, Mark?
Live in Watertown today, but next year we'll be moving to Eureka Springs. It's an artist community in Arkansas, and we were there last week. They've developed or started a citywide group howl at 8 p.m., and it's amazing how far the sound carries, but we've got neighbors in town, and they start howling at exactly 8 p.m. It goes for 1 minute, but it's funny, the conversations, the howl conversations that happen back and forth with people that don't really know each other. After about a minute, it stops, but then all the local dogs are howling too, so it's a riot.
Now, Mark, I got to ask, did you hear about this first, or did you hear the howling first and have to find the backstory after? Because that would be kind of spooky to hear it without knowing what was going on.
We were there working out in the yard, and at 8 o'clock, I start hearing what sounded like a wolf howl, and then other howls came in from other directions, and my wife asked me, what time is it? And I said, it's 8 o'clock, and she just smiled and said, yeah, we're doing the citywide wolf howl at 8 o'clock.
I love it. Mark, thank you so much for sharing that. Anya, I think that's the story you were thinking you might hear when you started off here.
Yeah, where was Mark when I needed him? That's exactly the story I was looking for. Someone who was doing a primal scream. That sounds like a great exercise.
That is fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing that one, Mark. Well, I want to share another story. One of our volunteers, Kathy Miner, says, as of yesterday, I've made 100 cloth masks and given away 98 of them. She puts a couple a day in their little free library. People take them. She doesn't know who takes them, and that's the magic. And that reminds me, one of your contributors wrote about the joy of caring for others during this time. Can you share that story?
Yes, this was a poet. Is a poet named Ross Gay, and he wrote a collection of poems and essays called The Book of Delights. So joy is sort of his specialty, and he wrote about the joy of caring for others. And it began with a friend that he ran into while out on a solitary walk, and she passed him a mask. And then he sort of goes into this whole, you know, beautiful meditation on what it means to care for others and how much joy that brings.
Fantastic. And there was one of our data people says a thing that brings him joy is to update his computer background with the new pictures of his only grandchild who turned one back in February. So whenever you minimize the work, they see the grandkid. Speaking of pictures, I want to hear one more. This is a real little thing that somebody's getting satisfaction from, the joy of deleting many mediocre photos from their phone.
Yes, this was by Katie Weaver. And, excuse me. that was another one where I was like, really? This is the joyful exercise. But she talked about deleting mediocre photos from her phone. She likened them to Frankenstein's creature. And she said, you know, we carry it across time and terra. And by deleting the really bad photos on her phone, she was unburdening herself and she felt so much lighter. So I thought that was a funny example of joy.
In our last minute, Anya, can you talk a little more about what you are doing to find joy, whether before this piece or inspired by some of your contributors?
Well, I thought about that a little bit, and there are two ways. One is I have an Apple TV, and when it goes into sleep mode, it shows these really beautiful drone and helicopter shots, sort of aerial shots of landscapes and cities in the normal times. So I've been losing myself in those because that's the only travel I can do now. The other thing that's bringing me joy is sarcasm. It is not normally my favorite form of humor, as my husband can tell you. I don't appreciate it. I just don't like it. But when things were so bad, I found it so fun to pretend that they were so good. So that was very cathartic to me.
I'm a fan of sarcasm at all times. But your other example, Anya, reminds me of something that I probably wasn't going to admit. But since you did, so I stumbled across people are doing these videos they take from in front of trains going through, you know, Switzerland or Greece or whatever. And then somebody else puts techno music over them. And I looked, I saw a link and I thought, oh, that sounds dumb. And I'll look at it for a minute. And I've watched actually probably a few hours at this point over the last couple of weeks. They're amazing and meditative and contemplative. And it's actually a lot of fun.
Sounds kind of exhilarating, too.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, super cool scenery that I'll never get to see, probably, because I'm never going to be a train engineer in Greece. Well, that's all the time we have, Anya. Thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks so much. And I just wanted to say that readers can find this at nytimes.com/joy if they want to read all the different forms of joy.
Fantastic. Anya Stremian is a deputy editor in the style section of the New York Times. We've been talking about that piece, 14 Ways We're Finding Joy in Spite of Everything. We've also popped a link up at WPR.org/Central Time if you're going there anyway. You can keep sharing your small joys on the Ideas Network Facebook page. A couple more from our coworkers. Tom Blaine says the joy I've been feeling lately is getting out on my bike and riding through the countryside. Our top boss, Mike Crane, says the same. Lori Skelton, who you hear on Food Friday, says it's warm enough to enjoy a beverage on my porch again. Larry Mueller is enjoying working in the garden with his daughter. Fantastic. Keep sharing yours. Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8:30 on The Morning Show, the host of Wisconsin Foodie joins the program for a look at the impact of COVID-19 on restaurants around the state and how they're trying to get through the tough time. That's tomorrow morning at 8:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, according to new data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the United States birth rate is at a 35-year low. Last year, there were 3.7 million children born in the U.S. The rate is down a percentage point from 2018. The drop was seen in all age groups except for women in their early 40s. They saw a slight increase in birth rate. Our next guest joins us for a look at the reasons behind the decline. Jennifer Glass is a Centennial Commission Professor of Liberal Arts in the Department of Sociology and Research Associate in the Population Research Center at the University of Texas, Austin. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be with you today.
What is your initial read on this statistic?
This is not at all surprising news. As the report says, we're just at the culmination of a 35-year trend, and as far as we know, it could continue to go down. The United States is singular in its refusal to enact policies that could, in fact, improve our birth rate, unlike our European counterparts, who have taken fairly aggressive measures to try and improve their birth rates.
Right. You've done studies on what you call the parental happiness gap, comparing the U.S. To other countries. What sorts of things are you looking at, and how might that inform people's decision on whether or not to have kids?
Well, it's interesting because when you ask parents, of course, they will tell you that their children are wonderful. It was the best decision they ever made, and they love them completely. I'm a parent. I feel exactly the same way. But when we ask more objective questions about the level of happiness and satisfaction that people feel with their lives, just generically, what we find is that in the United States, people who are parents of minor children, but even people who are parents of grown children, report lower levels of well-being, specifically happiness, than people who are quite similar in age and education and income who never had children at all. So we call that the happiness gap. And we looked at it cross-nationally across the European Union, around 22 countries. And we were surprised to find that the gap is largest by far in the United States. And it's smallest by far in the Nordic countries and in France. And in fact, there are a few countries where it's actually flipped. And parents of minor children are happier than people who decided not to have children. So we wanted to explore the reasons behind that. And we focused on several work-family policies that would make it much easier for families to continue to work and earn income while their children are growing up. And that seemed to be the key. When you enabled the labor force participation of mothers and fathers with things like relatively long paid parental leaves, generally in the area of 4 to 6 months for each parent, and in, specifically when we looked at the cost of childcare for the average toddler, so we're talking 2 to 3 year olds, and countries that heavily subsidize that cost and put it as part of their public educational system had higher birth rates than countries that did not do those things. And the final policy that made a difference was just ordinary paid sick and vacation leave. The more a country offered as a statutory benefit for all workers, the smaller the happiness gap between parents and non-parents. Because these things give parents time and they give parents money to have families. And that's what parents in the United States sorely need at present and have a difficult time getting.
Going back to the declining birth rate itself, is there a value judgment here from your perspective? Is it a bad thing that the birth rate is going down, or is there good and bad mixed in there?
It's pretty much a bad thing, and I'll tell you why. It's a bad thing because we're an aging society, and what we need are productive workers between the ages of 18 to 65 to help support an increasing population that's older than 65. And we've traditionally done this with Social Security, but we've also done it with annuities and pension funds on the stock market and things like that. All of those are at risk if we don't have a vibrant, active, working-age population. We used to augment our low birth rates with a very welcoming immigration program. And for a variety of highly political reasons, we've stopped doing that. And what you see, of course, is an even faster decline in the birth rate when you do that. So we have been depending not only on immigrants, but the higher birth rates of immigrants to this country for several decades now. And that process is running its course. And so we expect to see, even among recent Hispanic and Asian populations that in the first generation at least had relatively high birth rates, we see all of those cohorts aging out and their descendants having small family sizes just like every other American.
Talking to Jennifer Glass, professor of sociology at the University of Texas at Austin, looking at a new CDC report showing a long-term decline in birth rates here in the United States. Last year, the most recent data, the lowest in about 35 years. One piece of news that people might see as good news, the teenage birth rate. What are we seeing there?
That's been on a long-term decline for almost 30 years now, and that's universally a good thing. We like having births postponed until young women are capable of supporting themselves and their children and are healthy enough and have completed their education. So those are the crucial benchmarks for healthy pregnancies and healthy kids. And so that's a very good thing. Now, what we want is to see that fertility postponed into the 20s and 30s. But increasingly what we see is that it's very difficult for young people to imagine themselves forming households and raising children. They don't feel financially secure, and they don't feel like they can afford to have a home of their own. And for many people, being able to partner and live together and raise your children together is sort of the quintessential bottom line before they're willing to have children.
Now, we've seen periods of economic uncertainty through, I guess, all of human history, but we're still here. Did we do things differently as societies that allowed us to have stable, successful families, even with financial insecurity?
Well, you have to remember that until the past century, most people lived in agricultural communities, and children were a source of wealth. They were your labor force. So having kids was a good thing to do. And for most of history, when there was enough food to eat, that would enrich you, that would give you laborers, and that would enhance your wealth, and it would provide you with security in your old age. But we've kind of ruined that in the 21st century. So now there's no real economic advantage to having children, and they continue to cost you throughout their childhood and into their young adulthood now. So we've really changed what it means to have children. The benefits of having children really accrue to employers who have these nice, well-educated workers coming off the assembly line from all of our schools and colleges and universities, and for government tax-paying citizens who obey the law. So the benefits now accrue to everybody universally, even though parents engage in most of the expenditures to get them there. So that's really what's going on. When we saw the Great Depression, for example, birth rates plummeted because we were an industrializing nation. We were an urbanizing nation. Agriculture was in turmoil at the time. So it didn't make sense to have kids. Didn't make sense to have kids during World War II. So the baby boom was really a whiplash, not just to a decade and a half of low fertility, but also the booming of a post-war economy. Both things were taking place at the same time. Until we see that booming economy, I don't think we're going to see even a boomlet in fertility.
We're talking to Jennifer Glass, professor of liberal arts in the Department of Sociology and research associate in the Population Research Center at the University of Texas at Austin. She's with us to talk about the news that the U.S. birth rate is at a 35-year low, how we got here and what it means. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have big picture questions about the birth rate, or do you have a story to share from your own life about you or someone you know making that decision? Kids now, kids later, economic uncertainty getting in the way, policies that might or might not have helped you make that decision? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about a 35-year low in the United States birth rate, the factors that got us there, and what it could mean for the country in the future. Jennifer Glass is with us, professor of liberal arts in the Department of Sociology and research associate at the Population Research Center at the University of Texas at Austin. Got a PhD, by the way, from UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think about that news of the declining birth rate in the U.S.? And what is it that led to your decision whether to have kids, when to have kids, put it off till you're more financially secure? Does that time ever really come around? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hello.
Hello. Hi, Professor Glass, fellow UW grad. nice to hear you. I had a comment that basically our system of capitalism requires a positive growth rate in the population. It, basically, a corporation survives on either reducing its costs of goods or selling more of its product. And if you have a reduction in your population, well, then each remaining person has to consume more, or it leads to offshoring your business to the lowest cost, generally labor market. And I think that's where the United States is at, where we've basically gotten to a point where we either need to maintain or increase our growth rate or continue to offshore jobs.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. So, Jennifer, the low fertility rate isn't sustainable in our capitalist economy, and maybe vice versa.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. That's an excellent point. Yeah, we've relied on growth, and when we couldn't get it here, we exported our products abroad to large consumer markets and kept pressing to open places like China, and India, of course, which have an enormous number of potential consumers. But the chickens have come home to roost because those countries are now starting to produce for their own nations. And so we have to figure out a way to have a sustainable economy without this constant drumbeat of growth. And I think that you can have a vibrant economy without the assumption of constant growth and exporting, especially in developed nations, because if our populations continue to grow, fortunately, we're not in danger of doing that. We're all losing population right now. But we're very energy intensive. In fact, the last statistic I saw said that one American child was worth about 337 Bangladeshi kids. So we need to really think about how we can keep our footprint on the earth small and environmentally sustained. But at the same time, we don't want to have an elderly and graying population without a productive and active labor force. And we also don't want what that tells us about us as a society, that we simply are not supporting young families and we are not supporting children. And we are putting way too much of our energy and emphasis on the second half of life, how to maintain a private healthcare system that costs an enormous amount of money to keep people alive generally for the last 6 months of their lives. So that's kind of a different problem, but it's a problem of spending and allocation of resources and where we've exaggerated costs and where we need to rein them in and where we need to spend more and think about ways to help young families achieve their own fertility goals. Right now we have a system where most people say they want to have, they want to have two children, but they end up not having two children because they feel like they can't afford it.
Thanks for the call, Mike. We'll go to Ben with us now in La Crosse. Ben, hello.
Hi. The use of the term improve for the birth rate, meaning increase, is a value judgment. Almost all of the ills that we face currently in terms of global warming, in terms of the current pandemic, in terms of food and water security, in terms of pollution, have to do with the fact that we're approaching 8 billion people on the planet, and that is far beyond the carrying capacity of the planet. So one of the few bright spots is the fact that birth rates are declining in different parts of the world, including developing nations. I applaud that. There is some short-term problems in terms of rearranging the society's expenditures in terms of the point about the elderly graying population. But since the society has been set up under capitalism to constantly increase, and since we're clearly reached the limits of our ability for the planet to sustain us, we can't keep going that way.
Ben, thanks for the call. So Ben, seeing a declining population growth as good news, Jennifer.
Oh, absolutely. And I completely agree that we've achieved outstanding successes throughout the developing world in getting populations to reduce their rate of growth. And many, many of those nations are now below replacement as well. Most people don't realize, for example, that Brazil is now at below replacement fertility. Mexico is headed for below replacement fertility by 2050. In fact, most demographers believe that global population will peak sometime in the next 30 to 50 years, hopefully at about 9.5 billion, and then we'll slowly start to decrease. I completely agree that that's too much, but the fact that we will see this slow decline, hopefully with the ingenuity of human invention so that we can lower our carbon footprint, we will be able to sustain a global population of perhaps 7 to 8 billion. This will require massive new technological advances in energy in particular. We simply cannot continue to rely on the burning of fossil fuels for the energy demands that we have on the planet. But there are many people who think that we can have sustainable food production, for example, for as many as 7 to 8 billion people.
Thanks for that call. Just 30 seconds or so, Jennifer, what are you going to be watching for as new numbers come in this year of the coronavirus?
Well, I'm going to be watching in particular those people who are entering cohabiting unions and are getting married, because those are usually the statuses in which people plan pregnancies. But with a 20% unemployment rate, with the continued insecurity in terms of what we may or may not see in the future in terms of economic growth and in terms of housing, I think that we can expect at best anemic birth rates going into the future. These are economic problems that have hit Americans of childbearing age in particular. So we're talking about people in their 20s and 30s, the millennials and the generation following them. They're on track to have record low numbers of children and record postponement of pregnancy. And I haven't even begun to talk about what that does. We're meant to have kids in our 20s and early 30s, not to postpone into our 40s.
Thanks to our guest. To jump in there, thanks to Jennifer Glass. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Texas, Austin, looking at the declining birth rate in the United States. Wisconsin has gotten a lot of attention for being an important swing state in this year's presidential elections. As part of WPR's Why Wisconsin project, we recently received a question from listener Rachel Thorson about that. Rachel asked, what about Wisconsin's people and culture led to it being a swing state? How long has that been the case? WPR's Laurel White set out to answer that question.
How long has Wisconsin been a swing state? Off and on for a very long time. For more than a century, Wisconsin has had several distinct periods when its elections were close and its voters flipped party allegiances from one election to the next. According to Jonathan Kasparek, professor of history at UW-Milwaukee, one of those periods was in the late 1800s.
Some of those elections were really close between the Republicans and the Democrats.
In those days, Kasparek says voters' party allegiances had a lot to do with their ethnicity and religious affiliation. Republicans tended to be Wisconsin natives or Protestant immigrants.
If you were a Catholic or German or German Catholic, the Democrats were a much more attractive party.
Sometimes, very specific groups would shake up that balance. For example, German Protestants did their own thing, became a key voting bloc, and swung multiple elections. In the early 1900s until the 1930s, Wisconsin looked less swingy on the surface. Republicans won election after election. But Kasparek says that doesn't mean there was ideological unity, because Wisconsin's Republican Party had factions back then. There were traditional Republicans, and then there were progressive Republicans, led by Fighting Bob La Follette.
The Republican primary between the progressives and the stalwarts, that was kind of the swing area.
La Follette's progressives eventually split off to form their own party. Another swing period for Wisconsin came in the 1960s. Wisconsin voters went from supporting Republicans to Democrats and back again in presidential elections and governor's races. Barry Burden is director of the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison. He says flip-flops between party control then were driven by independently minded voters and state parties that played things closer to the middle.
And that would lead people to cross over and support candidates because they liked them, not because of their party affiliation.
Some of Wisconsin's most well-known politicians came from this time period, like Republican Governor Warren Knowles and Democratic Governor and U.S. Senator Gaylord Nelson. Wisconsin started to look less like a swing state in the 1980s. Democrats won 7 presidential elections in a row here, beginning in 1988. But Burden says that only tells part of the story. Some of these elections were as close as it gets. For example, Al Gore won Wisconsin in 2000 by fewer than 6,000 votes. John Kerry won in 2004 by about 11,000 votes.
Those were just tiny margins, smaller than Trump's margin, but they get counted in the Democratic column because the Democrat won the state. But man, those could have gone the other way.
Tight margins are getting more common these days. For nearly the entire 20th century, Wisconsin never had a presidential election decided by less than a percentage point. Since 2000, it has had 3. According to experts, one of the biggest reasons the state is so politically divided today is the way Wisconsin's population is spread between urban and rural areas. Kathy Kramer is a political science professor at UW-Madison.
The balance of rural and urban is roughly equivalent in Wisconsin, and nowadays, we know quite a bit about how that tends to correlate with partisan leanings.
A number of recent studies, including a 2018 analysis by the nonpartisan Pew Research Center, have shown rural voters are consistently voting with Republican candidates these days. Meanwhile, Democrats have strengthened their support with urban voters. Amber Wachowski is a professor of political science at Marquette University.
Democrats over the last several decades have actually grown their vote shares in the highly populated parts of the state.
Experts agree the urban-rural divide has been brewing in Wisconsin for decades. Burden thinks it started around the 1960s with the development of suburban communities. He says the current divisions are in a kind of magical balance with one another. So Wisconsin's long history as a swing state might not be changing anytime soon. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This story came from an audience question as part of the Why Wisconsin Project. Submit your own question, and we might be able to answer it in a future story. You can go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. You can also find this story and more stories like it at WPR.org/swingstate. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll check out some of the biggest stories in national politics, including the president's threat to move the Republican National Convention out of North Carolina this summer. Northern Wisconsin is getting a late start to the tourism season with concerns that a COVID-19 outbreak could overwhelm local health care. A new WisContext report tells us how they're getting ready. And a lot of people are out in their gardens these days, and they're experiencing the smell of dirt. A science writer tells us why dirt smells like it does. Spoiler, it's not the dirt. That, and look at some of the other top news stories of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.